Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. In this episode, I am talking with James Marcus. James is an editor, translator, critic, and writer. He was editor-in-chief at Harper's Magazine. He's also worked at Columbia Journalism Review. And he is the author of the latest book, Glad to the Brink of Fear, Portrait of Ralph Waldo Emerson. And that's what we talk about in this conversation. The book is fabulous. The book is absolutely fabulous. I kind of say in the beginning of the conversation, didn't really know what to expect. It's not a strict biography. It's really, really amazing the way he wrote it. He basically takes major themes from Emerson's life and kind of talks about them and writes about them, how it is for him, and just larger. So themes such as identity, relationships, individuality, many of the things that Emerson was thinking about. And it's just a wonderful way to write a book. I really, really enjoyed reading that book tremendously. So I highly recommend folks go pick that up. So we start by talking about how he framed the book and why he decided to write it that way, and how he chose various themes from Emerson's life. We talk about Emerson's religious background, his relationship with religion over his lifetime, Unitarianism, which he was a part of. And we also talk about identity. When do we become us? Right? When does that happen? It's a fascinating question. We also talk about first and second marriages. He's got some interesting ideas there. Self-reliance and individualism. Nature, slavery. This was obviously going on in the 19th century in the United States, and it was very interesting. Emerson's interactions with slavery, his ideas about it, how they evolved, what his legacy is, and many more topics. Really, really enjoyed this conversation. James is such a wonderful person. He's absolutely brilliant, fantastic writer. His book's very good. So I was just really happy with the conversation overall. As always, you can find this conversation and all the conversations at conversiondialogues.substack.com. I'm also on YouTube. So get over there, subscribe. It's free. Listen to this one. Listen to many other past episodes. Feel free to engage on the Substack, in the comments on YouTube, whatever. I usually try to respond to folks. You can obviously email the podcast as well. Share with your friends and share online. All that's very helpful and much appreciated. And now I bring you James Marcus. I'm here with James Marcus. James, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm greatly looking forward to talking with you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. You've written a fabulous book called Glad to the Brink of Fear, A Portrait of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Some folks may know who that is. And for those that don't, we'll get all into it. Before we do, why don't you tell listeners just a brief snapshot of who you are professionally, academically, and all the relevant details about you?
Sure. I've had the classic patchwork career of a freelance writer. I've worked as an editor. I've worked as a translator. Did a lot of work as a sort of cultural critic and journalist. Mm. I spent 5 years in the great hall of mammon known as Amazon.com. Working as an editor and writer and all sorts of undefinable tasks for that company. Most recently, I was the editor of Harper's Magazine. I spent about 8 years there, the last two as editor-in-chief. I left Harper's in 2018. And since then, I've been doing a lot of work on this book, finishing it up because it was a very long-term project. Also continuing to write book criticism. And I'm now teaching at the Arthur Carter School of Journalism at New York University as well.
Oh, very nice, very, very nice. So you have quite the spread there of different things, which is great.
I'm quite a bit. Yeah,
that's great. So I guess for this book on Emerson, I mean, how did it start? Was it you were just a fanboy and you said I got to write a book on him, or did you have like some particular thing you were trying to do, or what was it, I guess, that kind of motivated you to write the book on Emerson?
My fanboy phase concerning Emerson probably goes back around 25 years. I was having quite a rotten, challenging, miserable time in life, a time when I was looking for a little bit of consolation. And surprisingly, I began to turn in the, you know, late evening hours to this old Penguin collection of Emerson's essays, which in many ways is a weird place to turn for consolation, because he's not a writer of personal essays at all in our sense of that word. There's very little exposure of his personal life, of his own circumstances in those essays. And he can be quite lofty. You know, he comes out of a pulpit tradition. But I did find that in my miserable state that I was really responding to some parts of those essays. And I realize in retrospect that there is a note of sort of ecstasy and joy that runs through them. It's not there all the time, but every now and then he attains this kind of joyous state, and it's very contagious. You know, it's communicated to the reader. The other thing is that despite writing in what many readers of today would view as a fairly fancy, elevated style, I think he is always trying to tell the truth. He doesn't always get there. You know, he goes down blind alleys like every human being. But you read enough of his work and you sense that there is a truth-seeking impulse there all the time. And those things appealed to me greatly, and they buoyed me up a little at a time I was, you know, feeling really terrible. And then from there, I wanted to know more about who this person was. So I read both biographies and his more informal writing, you know, his journals and his letters. And I mean, his journals are a monument of American literature. If he had never published anything and his journals were simply dug out of the garage, you know, in 1900 and published, he would be a great American writer. But certainly you see him there in a more unbuttoned, informal 3D mode as a human being and not as an exalted sermonizer. So I went deeper and deeper down that rabbit hole. I got more and more interested in Emerson. I did not think for a long time that I would write a book about him, because I couldn't really imagine going to an agent or editor and saying, I got something hot for you. I want to talk about Ralph Waldo Emerson. It never occurred to me, but in fact, what happened is round about 2013, an agent who is now my agent, but who I happened to be having lunch with, said to me out of the blue, have you ever thought of writing a book on Emerson? To my great shock, you know, with my hair standing in, and I was, what kind of crazy talk is this? And he had a very specific angle of attack in terms of selling the book to a publisher, which is that Sarah Bakewell's book, How to Live, about Michel de Montaigne, had come out not that long before and had won a very substantial audience in America. And my agent's thought was, Emerson is our Montaigne, and Emerson is much more central to American literature than Montaigne is. So if that book had an audience, why not an audience for Emerson? And my agent was also a fanboy. You know, that really helped. And so with that kind of guidance, I wrote a proposal. And, you know, to my delight, a little bit of surprise, but mostly delight, he sold the book. And I, you know, embarked on a longer voyage than I thought back in 2013. But some things take time. And it's certainly a better book for the long kind of marination in the material.
So the book took you 10 years to write.
Yeah, off and on. I mean, wow. I had a full-time job, of course. The first five years I was at Harper's, and particularly a job where you're wrangling other people's prose all day long, a task that I really loved, and I worked with amazing writers, but you don't tend to come home at the end of the day with the tank very full. You know, you want to just, you know, watch TV or something and not plunk yourself in a chair and write. So there were a lot of delays, and I was doing a lot of other things. And I would really say it wasn't till around 2019, 2020 that I just really, I had to bear down and get the project done. And then a lot of it got written in a much swifter pace.
There's an interesting way in which you write the book, which I thought was, I don't know, I haven't really seen it done that way. So it's not a, you know, Emerson was born, you know, on this day to these parents, and he grew up in this town. And, you know, it's not quite entirely biography. There's many elements of that. But you really take it at themes, kind of interspersed at different points in his life, which was so, so cool. And he is this kind of like big towering figure and kind of an enigma in some ways. And how did you decide to write the book looking at themes instead of just this kind of like chronological or strict, I should say, chronological story of him?
Yeah. Well, you know, there already exist several really fantastic cradle to grave biographies of Emerson, you know, The thing is, biographies started to be written of him while he was still alive. Mm-hmm. So there's actually quite a long tradition of Emerson biographies. But, you know, Robert D. Richardson wrote an amazing book called The Mind on Fire, which I many people would still say is kind of the gold standard or benchmark. Mm-hmm. That was preceded, I think that book was in 95. It was preceded by a wonderful biography by a guy named Gay Wilson Allen in 1985 called Waldo Emerson. So those books are out there, mm-hmm. you know, relatively recent, very completest versions of Emerson's life. So I didn't think I needed to write another. You know, mm-hmm. no one needed that. They can go to those really wonderful books. I thought it would be useful, though, and more interesting for me and the reader to write a more idiosyncratic book that was selective in its design mm-hmm. and deliberately non-chronological. Mm-hmm. Now, parts of the book are chronological, and the book has biographical chapters and episodes, and I think you get most of the key points from my from where I'm sitting mm-hmm. of Emerson's life. But my goal was not to tell it all. Mm-hmm. My goal was to, you know, let my own sensibility be a kind of dowsing rod or Geiger counter and gravitate to the things that were hot for me, you know, that were the most telling, revealing episodes in Emerson's life. And I would say that, you know, he licenses you to do that in a way himself. You know, he liked to read books just for the most scintillating passages. He called it reading for the lusters. And in a certain way, he suggested that a human life could be understood the same way. You know, that there were a certain number of golden hours and episodes where everything was operating at top intensity, and those would tell you the whole story. So I felt that he was waving me on. You know, he was saying, you don't have to tell it all. It's perfectly fine to put together the pieces of it that you think are most revealing. And I mean, I didn't do them in strict chronological order because in a sense, we're all the narrators of our own life constantly. We are constantly looking back at every moment and reconstructing it and making it into a story, well, that is agreeable to us, but that we hope is truthful. But the thing is, when we make that story, it's not a soup to nuts chronological account. We too orchestrate it. You know, we too make the pieces that matter to us the most loom larger. And so in a way, I was trying to reflect the way our life is lived in our imagination. Mm. So that was another reason for it.
Mm. Yeah, that's very nice. Yeah, in some ways we do, we kind of remember our lives in narrative form. Right. In some ways we have stories about ourselves is how we remember it.
We can't really reconstruct our life without a narrative frame.
Yeah.
But of course we don't necessarily do it in order and we don't necessarily do it mm-hmm. correctly. From
that's right.
Subjective point of view, but that's, right. that's the story. Mm-hmm. That's the one we're assembling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I, you know, kind of looking at it, I followed a lot of the same kind of pattern here, and I was looking at a lot of the themes. And one theme that comes up is this phrase that stuck out to me. You can talk about it, but and this idea of his, you know, personally his background. There's a lot of religious background that's there, and he's mm-hmm. actually part of the church, and he's you know. Doing ministry and all these things. And then he leaves it at a certain point, like actually leaves it. And I believe it's over the, one of the sacraments of the Lord's Supper.
Over the Lord's Supper, Holy yeah. Communion.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so maybe just tell, I guess, you can tell some of the biographical pieces of it, but you talk about how basically I had this feeling, I don't know if it's explicitly stated in the book, but it's like when you do something so specific and then it's like, well, I don't really believe in all this, or I don't believe elements of this, mm-hmm. but I have this skill set of sermons or preparing or mm-hmm. speaking or leading. Well, it's like, well, what do you do with that? And so it seems like he kind of, you know, goes to what you call this, you know, this secular sermon, which I think is great. I think it's great. And he's got wonderful prose and all this stuff. So yeah. What was it about that element of his life that kind of put him on the path of saying, I'm going to do mostly essays. I'm going to do these kinds of ways of doing these kind of secular sermons.
Well, a key thing you have to understand about Emerson is that he came from seven generations of ministers. That's not an incidental fact. That's a key formational fact in his life. The ministry was the family business for the Emersons. And just like it is now, there can be terrible pressure to go into the family business. even if you don't want to. And Emerson was not particularly eager, as say a teenager, to become a minister. He wanted to become a writer, so he was resisting the family business. You know, it's like the jazz singer with wigs and horses. You know, just musical. But he didn't want to go into the business. You know, he agreed to do it at first because his father had died when he was 7 years old. It left his family, you know, semi destitute. He came from a group of five brothers, and not only was there pressure to go into the business, but also to help support the family, which desperately needed money. His older brother was the first choice, William, to become a minister. He was sent to Göttingen, Germany, which was then the powerhouse of theological studies in the worldwide. And he washed out. He had a crisis of faith. He came back to America. He moved to Staten Island, became a lawyer. Okay, so he wasn't going to do it. So at this point, Waldo Emerson, as he was called, reluctantly said, okay, I'm going to do this. He went to Harvard Divinity School. He got his training. He had a bumpy path to the ministry because he had a lot of health problems along the way. But eventually, he was ordained, and he had a congregation of his own in 1829 at the Second Church. But I think there were long germinating doubts about the legitimacy of 19th century Christianity in his mind. And this had been going on for a while, a feeling that it was a somewhat fossilized church and a fossilized belief system, and that to be a human being in 1830, you needed a new set of beliefs. You needed a fresh set of instruments to understand the universe. And so during the three and a half years he was a minister, you know, if you read his journals, there is a sort of slow crumbling away of his commitment to those principles and to that church. He tended to turn a lot of his, you know, sardonic disdain onto the Unitarian Church in particular, because he was a Unitarian. But it extended beyond that, I think, to Christianity in his day. You know, he felt it was calcified and not useful anymore. And because I think he had a very, very solid sense of integrity, he was unwilling to go through the motions. He didn't say to himself, so what if I only believe in 50% of it? It's a job, which it was, and I'll just do it. He really couldn't do that. And so famously, there was this one thing, administering Holy Communion, which is, you know, giving the wine and the wafer to your congregation. And he wrote to his congregation at the Second Church and said, may I simply be excused from administering this one rite? In other words, he didn't just stomp out of there and say, I quit. Mm-hmm. He just asked not to be able to do this one thing that he felt hypocritical about administering. And they thought about it and they said, no, they refused to let him, they wouldn't let him out of it, give him a loophole. Now, I argue in my book that I feel that there was psychologically another thing going on there as well, which is that his first wife had died at the age of 19 of tuberculosis, a disease which includes much coughing up of blood, especially in her case. And I wondered whether there wasn't a deep psychological revulsion at a religious ceremony where wine turned into blood in your mouth. Mm-hmm. But Emerson never said that. That is my speculation. In any case, when he left the Second Church, he left institutional Christianity behind. He did, for, you know, a period of time, appear in other pulpits as a freelance minister, basically. But he never had a congregation of his own again. And soon enough, he stopped being a minister altogether. But luckily for him, it's as if there were two other horses waiting for him outside. One was that he transitioned from being a writer of sermons to a writer of essays, mm-hmm. and eventually lectures. And that was a great thing for him because they're both compact, persuasive forms of writing. It wasn't a huge leap to go from one to the other. And then the other thing that was a great stroke of luck for him is that the Lyceum lecture circuit in the United States came into being in the late 1820s and early 1830s. So a parallel move from the pulpit to the lecture platform was also available. So he sort of made the jump. He made the leap in both of these cases. And so he became, in the phrase you noted before, a kind of preacher of secular sermons. But they were not explicitly Christian in their orientation anymore. He really did leave that behind him and was quite critical of Christianity in ways that sometimes outraged his contemporaries.
Yeah, it's interesting, his whole arc. His various interactions throughout his life with Christianity. You know, I think it's interesting because he was already kind of you know, somewhat halfway there. I mean, the Unitarian Church is already sort of, you know, they're not fundamentalists, right? They're not far from me, right? I'm a little rusty here, but I don't think they believe in the triune God. I don't think they believe in original sin. Today it's very secular.
They were very major departures from the Congregationalism, meaning the Puritanism that preceded. And you know, again, Unitarianism itself was a generational revolt against Congregationalism. And the Unitarians were seen as blasphemous hotheads in their own time. Mm-hmm. And their own time had only begun around 1800 or something like that. But by the time Emerson was in his 20s, now Unitarianism seemed dried up and conservative to him.
Right.
And so Transcendentalism was now another generational revolt against the Unitarians, who were a very progressive, modernizing form of Christianity. So, you know, it wasn't like Emerson was revolting against Calvin.
Right,
a modernized form of Christianity, cutting edge Christianity of the day.
Right, right. That's what's so interesting about it is that even from where he started, I guess, and then kind of pulling away. It's interesting how that of the time, but even more so more recently, like how you could see that. It's like, you know, there's something, but kind of you were saying, you know, you have this generations of ministers and all that. And there's a kind of, you could say kind of like a quasi-cultural component, you know, within society at the time. But I think on what it was doing for him in his life and how much he saw it as needed or not, you know, it just seems like he just kind of, I don't want to say grew out of it, but he just became apart from it and says, this isn't really connecting. But to the larger point here is still using the kind of structure or using the elements of kind of how a sermon is, if you're going to give something persuasive or expository. And he basically just did that in lectures and essays. I mean, do you think that was a kind of intentional thing? Or he's like, well, how could I do this in, you know, a non-religious setting? How do you think he came about this way? He didn't write big, you know, manuscripts and big books. Like he was writing a lot of, you know, these pieces. Was that intentional? And how did he kind of progress with that way of writing generally?
Yeah, I'm sure he was well aware of the continuity, that it wasn't a great leap from a sermon to an essay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that the Unitarians themselves had a very strong tradition of literary style in their sermons. Mm-hmm. That was a matter of particular emphasis for them. Of course, the sermon had been one of the great American literary art forms for like 300 years by that time, because that's where a lot of the most intense intellectual and persuasive thinking was poured into that vessel anyway. Mm-hmm. But the Unitarians in particular were known for their sort of finery of style, and they read the Augustines, and they liked to sound that way, you know, like the elegant people like, you know, Steele and the Augustine essayists in England were very influential. Mm. And so I think Emerson definitely saw the continuity in terms of the delivery system. Mm. And you're right to say that he was not a person who wrote long books at any point in his career. I mean, he wrote something called English Traits, which is kind of a travel book and kind of a meditation on like race and ethnicity. And that is really the closest to a long form narrative that he did. Everything else was, well, his very first book, Nature, was in a sense a long essay or a little book. But he worked in the small forms. That's where he thought the intensity was. And then, of course, he would collect essays or lectures into book-length books, but he didn't do long-form narrative. And in fact, he wasn't even that interested in narrative as a form. He really liked the ruminative form of the essay and the way it could sort of go anywhere in any direction and follow just the path of his own intuitions and not a strict narrative course.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like we don't get as much of that today. I mean, I guess in some ways we do, in some ways we don't, but it's interesting how at that time, how he was using that and how we still look to that. You have this really cool theme in the book about identity. And there's this question of like, you know, as it relates to Emerson, but you can broaden this out of sorts of, which I thought was interesting is when does somebody become themselves? right? How do you become one's self? And I thought about this question. You know, yeah, there's ideas of, you know, there's human growth and development, there's identity, there's a period of adolescence, young adulthood, there's all these things that, you know, kind of, you know, any psych class will teach you. But I thought that was really interesting to ask it that way of like, when do you become you of sorts? Or when do you become like your, like how you identify? And of course we evolve over time, but I guess so. Why the framing that way? I thought it was interesting. I was curious what your thoughts were in framing it this way and seeing the kind of cycles and evolution that Emerson went through throughout his life, obviously marriages and death and, you know, leaving a religion and writing a certain way. And then towards the end of his life, you know, with probably Alzheimer's, it's just interesting how he, but when you think about people in general, when does that happen? Or is that always happening? And what do you think it is, I guess, for him specifically?
Yeah. I mean, I framed the book that way. That's how, as you're noting, the first chapter begins, because I just think it's a key question that Emerson never stopped asking. You know, it's an obsessional level question for him his entire life. The question of identity, the question of who you are and what is the self. And I also think it's a very latter day question. I mean, you know, identity is an obsession of our culture right now.
Oh, yeah.
Some of it in the sense of identity politics, some of it in the sense of, you know, brand new frontiers of gender identity that didn't even exist 10 or 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me a question that Emerson is asking that is electrifyingly pertinent to our moment is this struggle to figure out who you are, you know, what the self consists of. And I mean, in some ways, Emerson was looking back to philosophical traditions that preceded him. Now, I should stress that, you know, I don't think of Emerson as a philosopher because I don't think his thought is systematic enough in a way to have produced a philosophical system. In fact, his watchword is almost anti-systematic. He hates systems in a way, so it's very hard to then create one. But, you know, he was looking to philosophers of the self and philosophers of consciousness, including someone like John Locke, David Hume, Bishop Berkeley, and also Immanuel Kant, all of who were sort of asking, what is the self made of? And they had different answers. And he was very intrigued by some of those answers and in a way, like, jousted with them a lot in his own writing, indirectly, not always by mentioning them, but by bringing in their ideas and even asking questions as fundamental as, can we really make contact with another person? What sort of intimacy can we have with other human beings? And can we actually even make contact with them? You know, he famously spoke of what he called the porcupine impossibility of contact with other people. And I think that interested him as a philosophical dilemma, but I think because he was a withdrawn and shy person, it interested him as an emotional dilemma as well, because he was very familiar with feeling terribly alone and wanted to have communion with other people, was aware of his own, let's say, characterological obstacles to doing that. And so I think all of these things are bundled up in this notion of who you are. And he asked the question in one form or another his entire life. And he complicated the question also by insisting that we are constantly in flux, that we are at our most powerful and joined to the universe when you are, as he put it, shooting the gulf, like going from one state to another. And the minute you settle down into the kind of comfy chair of your conscious state, that the voltage drops down and that human beings are at their most intense when they are reinventing themselves. And that also that was something you needed to do consciously in some ways. In other words, you didn't just wait for fate and the world to reinvent you. You constantly looked at what you thought and what you felt. And if it no longer seemed valid, you changed your mind. You know, changing your mind for Emerson is not a matter of being fickle or frivolous. Changing your mind shows that you're alive and sentient, that there's a plasticity to your way of thinking, and that it's going to just keep changing for as long as you're alive.
Yeah, it reminded me of some of these ideas that people have about the self and who that is. And I've always gone to, yeah, some of the existentialists and even someone like Carl Rogers and many other people said this, you know, Coet said this to some extent of, you know, the self is an amalgamation of all experiences that we're having have had and we will have. That's the self. There's nobody inside of us, you know, pulling the levers and, you know, whatever, you know, there's no self inside. And it's the total components of our experiences and our relationships. And I still, the reason this kind of stuck with me was because I think that there are core elements of who we are that is stable over time. So this idea of time, of saying, well, when do we become ourselves? Like what it is to be you. And, you know, in some sense, you could say, you know, personality formation around 5 years old. Okay, that, sure. But I think like the essence of you and like who you are and when you're not, you know, in a certain stage, I still don't have an answer to that. But I think it is always in flux. You are always kind of developing. But that element where it's the what it means to be you and when that happens, you know, maybe it's different for everybody, but I think it's an interesting question to consider about, you know, what it is to be you or what it is for to be ourselves. It's a very, very fascinating one.
Of course. And I mean, I wasn't really approaching in this case from a sort of, for instance, child development point of view or something like that. I was just asking more generally, like, you know, a human being is a beautiful, idiosyncratic thing. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking at the life of another person for years at a time, it was partially my question of like, when does he seem recognizably himself to me? Mm-hmm. You know, when to an outside observer does someone who ceaselessly chronicled his own life, as many people did then, does he suddenly sound like the Emerson that we know and love?
Yeah.
I had my own answer to that. Mm-hmm. Of course, the version of the self that is preserved in journals and letters is its own thing. And that is a more complicated question too. But I was just kind of waiting for the moment when the pieces seem to click into place. You heard the voice that is so distinctive and so well known by now. Mm. And so I was kind of asking the question in that sense.
Yeah, and that's nice though. It's nice because I think from another perspective of when we have readers or people that are creating or even people we know personally, it's like, well, when do we see that? When does that click? You know, and it's like, it's very, very interesting. And I imagine it's kind of different for everybody, but it's a great question.
Yeah. I don't think it's a certain age where it happens to everybody.
People
who are like at age 9 are seem to be a weirdly fully formed version. And maybe with other people, it's like, hey, suddenly at 40, you've got, you know, kind of interesting. It's not one age. I think it's in everybody's sort of life journey. There's a moment.
Yeah.
Not a moment, but there's a period where they seem to be themselves. And that's really all I was suggesting. I
fully agree with you there. So I want to ask you about this idea of love and marriage. Now, I'm going to read a little bit of what you had because it was really, 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 really nice the way you said it. This is from the middle of the book. You said, there are first marriages and there are second marriages. The first is an exercise, always in blind faith. This isn't a bad thing. Faith is blind. By definition, it's a wager on something you feel so intensely that evidence is beside the point. Two young people agree to take a leap into the void. They understand neither themselves nor the other person. And this lack of understanding, this delicious opacity, is what makes the leap possible in the first place. Call it innocence. You go on further, which brings us to the second marriage. Experience, also delicious, has replaced innocence. Both parties are more fully formed. Some of the gaps in consciousness have closed up like fontanelles. You know what you want or you think you do. So the second marriage may resemble a mutual aid society or Warsaw Pact between consenting adults. The joy is there and the comfort and the invigorating strangeness of another person, but you are no longer playing house, no longer rehearsing. This is the real deal, the long march with plenty of time for love to turn into something else. Affection, maybe, or intolerance. And then magically reconstitute itself like a dinosaur from a microscopic dab of DNA. The duration of love, its weirdly irreducible quality, is the whole point of the second marriage. You expect less, and if you're lucky, you get more. Beautiful. It's fantastic. Great. It's great writing. Great writing. Obviously, you know, Emerson has been married twice, and there's things to say about his first and second marriage. But I really was really kind of just, you know, just kind of hit by that bit of it about thinking about marriage, you know, whether people have been married two times, three times, only once, never married, but this idea of, you know, when you enter into a relationship with somebody, you don't really know where it's going to go. You have an idea.
Sure.
And in many forms, now this is changing, I guess, over time in many, many parts of the world, but many people, they get married relatively young, let's say, and they have a family and they do all the traditional stereotypical things. And it's interesting how, again, you burn through all these cycles and you get to a certain point where you're like, well, who are you? Who am I? What are we doing? What are we still doing? You know, all these things. And you know, sometimes for some people that can be, you kind of clear the path of all of that. And if you get married a second time, or maybe even further, but a second time in this case, you don't have to do all of that necessarily. It's just different. Walk me through, I guess, some of your thinking here, because I never really heard it kind of expressed that way, and it was wonderfully written. That's why I read it. We can tie it to Emerson, but just generally this idea of marriage and kind of that kind of relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about it obviously a lot when I got to writing about the second marriage of Emerson, because in a rather extreme way, the first marriage was the intensely romantic, infatuated, doomed marriage. Because when Emerson met the teenager who would become his first wife, Ellen Tucker, she already had tuberculosis, was already, you know, advanced in the disease. Now, Emerson had it also, as did almost everyone in his family. He managed to hold it off, you know, but it killed his two younger brothers. It killed his first wife in combination with stomach cancer. It killed his father. Tuberculosis was the great killer of the 19th century, aside from war. So he met Ellen Tucker when she was 16. He was 8 years older. They got engaged when she was 17. They married when she was 18. And she died when she was still 19 years old. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy.
Yeah.
All we really have of her is about 40-odd letters that she wrote to Emerson that have been published in a little book of their own. And as I write in my own book, you know, you read these letters and you sort of fall in love with her. She's so charming and funny, down to earth. Even though she is younger than Emerson, she regularly sort of makes fun of him. She calls him grandpa in recognition of his, you know, elderly age of 24 years old, 25, whatever he was then. She is so absolutely charming. And he was so head over heels in love with her. And of course, the whole marriage was a kind of rehearsal for her death. She was very sick a lot of the time, and Emerson kept going to points at least a little further south with her because there was no cure for TB. It was not understood as a disease, but there was a grasp that hotter, warmer air could be better for you. But she was dying really from the moment they got married. Okay, so you have that romantic, you know, doomed intensity of the first one, which did not last long enough for them to really experience like the throes of daily life and the long march that is a marriage, just like you were saying, where sometimes you love each other and sometimes you drive each other crazy and you both mature and sometimes grow apart and move together and grow apart. And like the first marriage was, you know, trapped in a kind of exalted amber for Emerson because it never got to play out. And after Ellen Tucker died, I mean, it was devastating for him. He did not think he was going to get married again. You know, he famously said, there was one birth, there was one baptism, there was one first love. And I think he felt that door was closed. And then a few years later, he met Lydia Jackson. Now, Lydia Jackson was not 8 years younger than him. Lydia Jackson was not a teenager. She was, in fact, a little bit older than Emerson. She was extremely well-read. She was theologically very curious. She herself already kind of assumed she was settling into what she called a life at Spinster Hall, but she fell in love with Emerson and vice versa. But you sense in his courtship of her that he's kind of egging himself on in a way. I mean, clearly there was deep feeling there because he wouldn't have just married her on an impulse, but it's not a teen romance. It's not a romance of young people anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like two mature people who recognize that they may have differences. And I was just struck by what a different enterprise that is. Now, as it happens, I was married once before. And then, you know, I've been in a long-term relationship now for, you know, more than 25 years. So I'm not married to that person, but for all intents and purposes, it's a second marriage for me. And I mean, I still, you know love and love my first wife, and, you know, very dearly. It's not like I'm not trying to compare one to the other, but when you're in a second marriage, you see what the difference is, you know, that you've come into it as more fully formed adults. And a lot of the growing pains that are part of your late, you know, late teens or early 20s, let's say, are over. And also you have lived separate lives for longer. You may well have separate sets of friends and intellectual interests and spiritual interests. And I feel that there's a kind of grand alliance that is taking place, but between two partners who might be different. And in the case of Emerson and his wife, I mean, his second wife, rather, I mean, Lydia Jackson, who he called Lydia, and as soon as they got married, he sort of redefined her in that way. And on the other hand, she called him Mr. Emerson for the rest of the marriage. And he kept asking her to call him by his first name, and she wouldn't do it. So there's a kind of war of the names there that I find very funny as an exercise in defining the other party. But she went into the marriage thinking that her new husband was more of a conventional Christian than he was. And it's partly because his own Christianity and his letting go of it was going on before her eyes. And she, in a sense, became a more conventional Christian. And that was a very deep disappointment to her. It cast a real shadow over their marriage that, in fact, she was moving from a sort of eclectic DIY version of Christianity to something more conventional. And he was moving from that to not being a Christian anymore, basically. And it hurt her very badly. And also the fact that he was sometimes a very distant, chilly person who was aware of those things, but could not always surmount them. You know, he once apologized to her saying, you know, I'm better at being a photometer than a furnace, meaning I can absorb light and heat, but I don't emit light and heat very well. So he knew about it. And I think at times he really drove her crazy, you know, with his detachment and distance and her sense of being emotionally marooned. And like many women of her period, you know, she would sometimes take to her bed, you know, with Victorian era maladies that were probably sometimes real, sometimes not that she was a hypochondriac. I think it was an escape from a sort of emotional starvation at certain moments. So I'm aware that, like, you can't characterize their entire marriage, which went on for 46 years until Emerson died, as, you know, a bowl of roses the whole time. It clearly wasn't. And yet for me, it's touching to see the resilience of the marriage. They survived the terrible loss of a child, you know, which shatters many marriages. And, you know, you see their letters to each other, and I think there's a pretty persistent current of affection and supportiveness, if not always, oh gosh, I'm deeply in love with you. And to me, that's also part of the second marriage, that it's not always operating at a high boil, but it's also you having a sort of an alliance with somebody. You know, you're riding a bicycle built for two through life together, and it's a joint operation, and it provides happiness and stability. And it might not provide the lightning bolts of, you know, early love and infatuation, but that isn't usually the case for most people.
Yeah, that's very well said. It's interesting to think about. Yeah, with relationships, I think it's one of those things where it's you don't really know how things will end up, how things will happen, and I think that you're right. Is you know, many times I've said this in different contexts, but you know, marriage or being with somebody romantically is not only about love. That's a good foundation. That's important, but that's not all it is. There's so many things. Pragmatically, that are essential. This is, you know, hard work, and I think in the book you kind of see that there's this kind of pushing and pulling that they're doing for, you know, really most of, you know, until the end of his life. And so it's interesting how to think about, again, kind of to the bit I read, is, you know, when you're young, you have all of the romanticism and being in love, and that's important. But something about as you get older, or in his case, you know, with someone else, you kind of, the innocence is not gone. It's gone, and it's but that's not a bad thing, I don't think. And I think there's certain things that have their time and place, and there's a season, and then there isn't. And so it's very interesting.
No, something else replaces that innocence, and the fact that if you get married or get into a long-term relationship, particularly when you're very young, you yourself are unformed.
Yeah, right, right.
And so you're in a relationship where the two people are unformed and perhaps in some ways are very much forming each other.
Of course.
And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but that's the situation. Yeah. But you know, if you, by the time you get to the second marriage, you tend to be more formed. Mm. You tend to have a little bit of an idea of like what you want and where you're going. And so you may operate in parallel sometimes. There may be more parallel play mm-hmm. than there is in the first marriage. Mm. And okay, you've lost some of the scintillating, you know, first love, early infatuation, but mm-hmm. you've also gained a kind of maturity and maybe a capacity to understand a different person better than you could before. Mm-hmm. So it's a trade-off. And I'm not doing a, you know, a public service announcement for the second. Marriages are great, you know, and sometimes it takes four marriages. And also some people just shouldn't marry. But anyway.
I'm fully with you on that. Yeah, it is interesting though, because I feel like a lot of the times people do this thing where they're having another relationship or, you know, they end one, you know, and there's immediately into something else. And I think that doesn't always happen, but I do think it is interesting to know, you know, again, with relationships or marriages and things like that, of sometimes there is this space of, yeah, as you're saying, you're forming and you're having a better understanding of who you are and what you want to be. And I think that's really important. There's a few other big themes in his life. So one of them is this, I mean, it's one of the major, I think, pieces that people will know, but you know, Emerson wrote a lot about this work on self-reliance, mm-hmm. This idea of character, and what can you, for people that don't do a deep dive into Emerson, the thing that they might come across is self-reliance, you know, or maybe nature, which we can talk about in a minute. But what can we say accurately about what his thoughts were? You had mentioned earlier he was inspired by folks like Locke and others, but what do you think is his, the tenor of what he's trying to say with this idea of self-reliance? And second to that, how do we understand that in the 19th century and sort of accurately understand what that looks like now or how it's different about self-reliance in the 21st century?
Yeah. Let's start at the beginning. I mean, I think self-reliance was a central plank, not only of Emerson's thought, but of transcendentalism, mm. you know, as a belief system, let's say. And, you know, I think in a way the spine of transcendentalism, even though it is a very multifaceted philosophy, is this great reliance on intuitive, subjective understanding of the world. Mm. In other words, the great mandate was not to accept the version of the world that was given to you by the church or the state or your neighbors, or, you know, your bowling team. I mean, any crowd of people. Emerson was against crowdsourcing in a lot of ways. His idea was that, no, you should have what he called an original relation to the universe, mm. meaning that you look at it for yourself mm. and you figure it out for yourself mm. and you try to put it into your own language. You see the world as if it had never been seen before. And that was the clarion call, I think, of that essay and of transcendentalism altogether. And to me, that's still very beautiful and still very inspiring to try to see the have an original relationship to the world and the universe and decide where you fit into it on that basis. Mm. Now, there's a political and cultural aspect to it because Emerson was coming out of an intensely communal society. You know, I mean, particularly Puritan society was intensely communal. There were aspects of it, including the sort of endless examination of your own soul for, you know, spotty behavior that was subjective and personal, but it was organized in very communal lines. Mm. And Emerson felt that he had to push back against that, that the human soul was an individual thing, not always wholesale. You know, it wasn't always just a cog in a machine. And of course, he was seeing, when he was writing these essays, the early leading edge of industrialism in the United States. In other words, the U.S. was moving from a primarily agrarian country to the early phases of being an industrial country and a more urbanized country. So Emerson was seeing that too out of the corners of his eye and thinking like the crowd can be very depersonalizing and dehumanizing. So there's elements to all of this. But again, there's always the personal, emotional, psychological side of it, which is that Emerson himself was a withdrawn person. Mm. And I think that feeds also into an idea that his greatest topic would be what he called the infinitude of the private man, meaning interior life, subjective life, using that as the lens with which to view the world. Now, that was a very exciting notion in the 1830s, and it was a surprisingly new one. I mean, in fact, the word individualism was not coined until, I think, the 1830s, and it was by Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America. I think that's the first on record use of that word. Now, the idea had existed.
Yeah.
Even the idea in, say, France or England or other parts of Europe had a negative connotation. Individualism meant a rending of the social fabric, you know, tearing apart the bonds that made society work and insisting that it was you. Mm-hmm. And also, it was part of the whole Romantic movement that was coming out of Europe at the same time. So there's many tributaries feeding into this, but by the time it hit Emerson, it turned into a whole sort of gospel of self-reliance. Mm. And another part of that gospel was stop looking in the rearview mirror all the time. Stop letting history determine your course. He said, why should we rummage around in the rags and bones of the past? The thing he hated about his age, he said, our age is retrospective. He said, it builds the sepulchres of the fathers, meaning the funeral monuments of the people who had preceded us. And he didn't like any of that. Mm-hmm. You know, he wanted to face forward all the time, not to face back. Now, of course, this is contradictory because he loved English literature and history and was fascinated by it. So yes, he's contradictory all the time, but self-reliance is all about that. Mm. And I think it fed directly into the cultural bloodstream of this country. We were already a nation, you know, noted by the 1840s, as Emerson put it, you know, we were in the ear of the first person singular. Americans were known for their sort of atomized individuality. So I think his influence is huge there. But I would say, you know, to bring it forward into modern life, there is also a dark underside to that legacy, to that way of thinking, because it's true that an incessant stress on self-reliance does shatter community. You know, it does make you feel that it's all about the rights you have as an individual and that those should never be sacrificed for the good of the community. And that is just an incessant tug of war in American history going up till today. And, you know, I write in my book that I think that the COVID pandemic was a really interesting lens into that stuff. Now, it doesn't matter which side Emerson would take. I wasn't really trying to make that argument. What I was saying is you have a moment where the tug of war between individuals who don't want the government to vaccinate them and shut down their business and make them wear a mask, and communitarians who want everybody to do those very things was just violent, you know, and played out in the news and in politics and in popular culture. And so in that sense, I think that great Emersonian polarity is very much alive and well in American culture. There are some people who don't like Emerson specifically for his community eroding ideas of self-reliance. They feel like it's not a good aspect of the American character. I would just argue that it cuts both ways. For me, it's still very exhilarating. The idea that, like, you see it for yourself. Don't view the world as secondhand goods that everyone told you about. See it for yourself. And by the way, some of that was colored by Eastern philosophy, by a Zen or Buddhist philosophy. Emerson was one of the first Americans to read those things. And it certainly fed into his thought, you know, if it sounds familiar in that sort of way. But there's a downside to it, and it's foolish not to recognize it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that, you know, I don't think there's a kind of which way one or the other, but there is a way of there is something about it that's important. But yeah, it's not that he was, you know, anti the collective either. So I think that that's important to recognize. No, it's not a black or white thing.
No, I mean, and you have to stress that, first of all, he spent his entire adult life in the small town of Concord, Massachusetts. And he was very much part of the communal life of that town. It's not like he lived in a tower as a hermit. You know, he was the curator of the Lyceum branch there. And one thing that has really a tiny detail that drove this home to me, which I saw when I visited his house in Concord, which I've done more than once, which is now a museum, but it's pretty much kept the way it was. When you go in the front door, there are these things hanging above the entryway. And, you know, I said, what are those? And the guy said, oh, they're fire buckets. They're buckets full of sand, and everyone had them in their house. And if someone's house was burning, everyone in the community would run to the house with these buckets of sand to try to put it out. And obviously you would try to refill them. But the idea that Emerson was basically part of the volunteer fire department of Congress, and that the whole town was knit together with usages like that, was very touching to me. I mean, the other thing to note is that in the course of Emerson's evolution into being an abolitionist and a political activist, he very much came to recognize that only communal large-scale efforts could achieve certain things like the end of slavery. So again, there's, as there so often is, there's a flip side of the coin to him, which I feel is more of a yin and yang thing rather than, oh, he just contradicted himself. I think he was capable of holding two ideas or more in his head and not having his brain explode. And that's part of his greatness as a writer and a thinker.
When it comes to nature, obviously he has this title out, and you know, what was it that he was trying to understand about the aesthetic life? Why was that appealing for him? Where did he see this alignment between beauty and goodness? What was animating, I guess, his thoughts on nature?
Well, you know, in a way, the title of Nature is a little bit deceptive, because it makes you feel like you're going to read a beautiful song of praise to the natural world, something closer to Walden. I mean, Walden is not only that either. But in fact, Henry David Thoreau, a great, you know, disciple of Emerson's and a great friend and eventually a great, great writer, is really more of an environmentalist and a conservationist than Emerson is. I mean, Emerson loved his walks in nature, partly because he did get a sense of replenishment and joy from it, partly because it got him away from other people, you know, because nature was where you could go to get away from other irritating people. And when he wrote Nature, which was his first book, his first sort of transcendentalist call to arms, and something that sort of mapped out a lot of things he would write about for the rest of his life. Nature to him, most broadly in that book, was everything aside from his own consciousness. Everything outside of the self for him was nature. That included other people. That included the chair and the table and the, you know, textile factory up the river. It was a way to look at what is the relationship between your own consciousness and everything else in the universe. Now, nonetheless, he wrote some lovely lines in there about nature because, as I said, he did genuinely view it as an essential source of joy and replenishment and a kind of, what would you call it? A kind of glossary or dictionary of divine intent, you know. He did feel that you could read nature and everything else because he was very taken at that moment with the idea that there was a world of material things in which we dwelled every day and had our coffee, and that there was a world of the spirit, and that the two things were intimately connected, and that what you saw in nature was a kind of external sign or symbol of something that existed in a spiritual realm. So, yes, he felt that to understand anything around you, you had to essentially read nature like a beautiful text. Now, that's not quite the same thing as being able to identify all the flowers, you know, sleeping in the dirt or something like that. And in fact, when Emerson was a much older man, he took a trip to California where he met John Muir. You know, then in his early days as a great conservationist, he was a very young man and he worshiped Emerson. He was then kind of, you know, living in a weird birdhouse-like cabin, you know, near Yosemite or something. And Muir really wanted Emerson. Emerson was with a party of people, and Emerson was about 70 years old. And Muir really wanted Emerson to sleep over, have an outdoor sleepover, like where he would sleep on a pile of branches. And Emerson wouldn't do it. And Muir was very, very disappointed that Emerson was not behaving like a real outdoorsy kind of guy. So Emerson was that to an extent, of course. But the other thing that's going on is in nature is this idea that you need to be open to ecstatic experience. Because part of Emerson's argument is that, I mean, he made a distinction between things he called understanding and reason. I can't tell you how many years I spent trying to figure out that reason did not mean the rational part of your personality. I really regret that terminology, but I finally realized that reason was the subjective intuitive part of you. Understanding was the daily calculating, go about your business part of you. And Emerson felt that we lived in a kind of dual or double consciousness with both of those things, the visionary part of you and the everyday part of you. And to his great disappointment, he didn't feel that they commingled that often. But the thing about the visionary part of you is that, in a sense, Emerson lived for the moments when that descended into him. And a kind of influx of joy and understanding and connection to other people, an oceanic feeling, as it's sometimes called, would take possession of you. He thought that was the greatest sensation in the world. And part of the trick of it was that you could not turn it on and off like a light switch. You couldn't even really go off in search of it. You simply had to be alert and ready for it. And that's another Zen or Buddhist like part of his thinking, that like you were supposed to exist in a state of alertness where you were ready to suddenly understand more than you normally did. And of course, the climax of nature is the famous moment where he's strolling across the village common and he's lit up by this transcendent feeling, where he imagines himself to be a transparent eyeball. Now, that is a piece of language that has, you know, produced some chuckles in the 200 years since it was written, because it's such an extravagant, weird image. And indeed, there was a famous transcendentalist cartoonist named Christopher Cronje who did this famous image of Emerson's transparent eyeball with a top hat on, walking across the landscape on these spindly legs, which I think is both a homage and clearly a ribbing him a little bit. But what Emerson is saying then, he says, I become a transparent eyeball. All the currents of the universe flow through me. And he is talking about a moment where you're connected to everything. You feel yourself to be connected to everything. And of course, that's a very beautiful sensation, to not feel alone, you know, to not be inside the silo of your own consciousness, but to feel that everything human is somehow related to you, and everything cosmological. And I think that's one of the main arguments he made in Nature. And I mean, Nature concludes with this enormous sort of prophetic burst where he just says, these amazing things will happen and we will see the world as if a blind man had regained his sense of vision, and all terrible things will be, you know, washed away. And that's very grand. And to the modern ear, it may sound a little too exalted. But Emerson, you know, believed in these things. And if you tune yourself a little bit to the sound of his voice, and that's kind of the pace and the diction of his writing, he makes you believe it too. I mean, it's quite amazing. Well, you don't have to believe it literally, but the sense of joy and exhilaration is very contagious. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that was one of the things that attracted me to him in the beginning.
Yes, it's interesting to have such a perspective of yourself with others in nature, how you understand the relationships between these things. It's such a, it feels like a way that people don't think about things that much anymore. It's wonderful to continue to go back and read some of his thoughts on these pieces.
You're right about it. Like, I think many people would probably find some of these ideas like airy fairy in a way, or maybe new age woo woo.
Yeah.
But I think many, many people, if they really think about it, would recognize that they have had some experiences like this. Yeah. It doesn't have to be exactly like he's talking about, but you have moments where you feel like you know more and feel more.
There's a connection. There's a connecting.
There's a connection. Mm-hmm. And this is just one way of talking about it. I mean, Emerson himself said, not quite sincerely, I wish to exchange this flash of lightning faith for continuous daylight. Mm. First thing, in a way, I'd rather just have a better regular life than wait around for the lightning to come down and descend into me. But I don't think he totally meant that, because in a way he lived for those moments when the flash of lightning faith was lighting him up.
Yeah.
But you know, he was a very shrewd observer of daily life. I want to stress that, because he believed in this stuff, he didn't sort of sit around with a bunch of crystals on his desk. You know, he was, you know, as an observer of like politics, customs of the city, world, you know, history, he absorbed an incredible amount of stuff. And is particularly in his journals, there's a very shrewd notation of history and daily life and politics that can be a little surprising if you only know him as the mystical, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. eyeball.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess the last theme I want to ask you about is on slavery. You talk about he gets there, but it's, mm-hmm. it's a journey. I'm not saying he had to, you know, come out of the womb an abolitionist, but like there's a journey, and he does get there, but you know, and I think you made a note of it when you were you're in the chapter or whatever, one of the chapters where you write about, you know, what it was like to kind of tell this story, part of the story. Yeah, I guess what were his views on slavery and how they evolved and how you eventually got to abolitionism and just kind of where he kind of always sat, but then, you know, what it was that needed to evolve or evolve. Because I'm bringing it up because that was obviously a big, big thing of the day in which he lived. It wasn't like something he was looking at historically or after the fact, like it was in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, Emerson's relationship to not only slavery and abolitionism, but to race is so kind of brain-breakingly complicated and contradictory that, you know, I spent many thousands of words writing about it in my book. And also because we live in an age of, first of all, a healthy insistence that we look at these things more squarely in the face. And we also live in an age of sometimes an eagerness to cancel a historic figure who doesn't seem perfectly cut to the sentiments and feelings and political convictions of today.
Right.
And there's a constant back and forth there between what is a kind of presentism, mm-hmm. wanting Emerson to have all the opinions of, you know, what that I think he should have in 2024, and me recognizing the cultural context he came out of. And then also wondering, okay, so how much do you give him a get out of jail free card because of that? You know, these things are all kind of buzzing around and operating together. I just wanted to look at it and in a way have my own original relationship to this part of Emerson's life. Like, let me look at it all and see what I think, you know? And I mean, to describe some of the moving parts as simply as possible. Okay. Emerson never approved of slavery. From the time he was a teenager in his journal, he just said, it's a moral calamity. It's a catastrophe. You know, no one who wasn't making a living from it could ever even defend it. It has to be noted that Emerson was born in 1803, and slavery was illegal in Massachusetts in 1783. So Emerson had almost no direct observation of slavery throughout most of his life, really, but certainly in his formative years. And for that matter, you know, there were two or three dozen free Black people in Concord. There were a larger number of free Black people in Boston, but it was a tiny fraction of the population of Boston. All I'm saying is that Emerson was not hanging around talking to Black people. He didn't know any, you know, in his 20s or 30s. And so whatever conclusions he was drawing about Black people were in something of a vacuum. Okay, so on one hand, he always believed slavery was wrong, but was not sure how you got rid of it. At the same time, he certainly was willing to entertain some of the widely disseminated opinions of his era among white people, which was that white people were superior to Black people. The thing is that even many people who believed that slavery was wrong also felt that Black people were inferior to white people. This was not an unusual opinion in the North, in the northern half of the United States, you know, throughout the early 19th century. In that sense, I would say Emerson was doing what he told us later not to do. He was simply obeying the hive mind, taking it at its word. And again, with very little experience, really, if he had had a single Black friend, it would have knocked down many of these notions very fast, but he didn't. So what you have happening in these kind of parallel tracks then is, as we get into the 1840s, particularly the mid-1840s, Emerson began to be a very eloquent abolitionist speaker and activist. He was kind of slow to get on that bandwagon, but when he did, it was with a great deal of force. And some of the speeches he gave, starting in 1844, he gave a very famous address because it was the 10th anniversary of emancipation in the British West Indies. And he gave what I think is a fantastically effective speech then. And I think for the first time, he read very deeply in the literature of slavery and abolitionism. He learned a lot more because he knew very little firsthand. And I think from 1844 through the Civil War, he continues to make speeches, he raises money, he donates money to runaways, he gives money to John Brown, he raises money for the Massachusetts 54th, the first federal all-Black regiment. And I think he acquits himself pretty well, you know, in the eyes of history. The thing is that he was simultaneously, as a great reader of science, reading some of the race science of the day. The race science of the day, which we would not regard as science now at all, basically involved racial hierarchy, you know, with invariably the white people at the top, the people of color arrayed down the ladder. And, you know, confusingly, some of these books were written by people who had some scientific credentials. So they came clothed with this sort of fake authority of science. And so Emerson read some of these people, people like the Scottish surgeon and anatomist Robert Knox, a German polymath named Johann Friedrich Blumenbach. And so, you know, to, in a way that makes me wince, you will find in some of Emerson's writing, and particularly in the book I mentioned earlier, English Traits, there are a couple of chapters where he articulates this philosophy. And I find it's very hard for me to swallow, you know. And he has been rightly criticized for it by all sorts of people. To me, a little bit of a saving grace is that in the very same pages of that book, he does a very weird thing and undermines the ideas that he's just introduced. And, you know, my read of that is in some ways he knew that there was something a little bit rotten or unpersuasive. Nonetheless, he said what he said. You know, you can't erase these things. So there's a, and these things cohabit. In other words, they don't cancel each other out. You can't really say, well, he was a great abolitionist. So the fact that he, you know, promoted these doctrines of white superiority, even occasionally, it doesn't make that go away. You have to sort of, you try to assemble a kind of 3D image of this person with his flaws and with his, you know, truly inspiring elements, and try to figure out where you come out there. I mean, Emerson was undoubtedly ahead of many of his contemporaries. You know, he was saying from his pulpit in 1832, you know, the cause of the Indian, let it be mine. The cause of the black man, let it be mine. Most Unitarian preachers, and undoubtedly nobody in his congregation, was saying that. And I'm sure it alienated his flock. So it's a complicated and mixed bag there, you know, and it's hard to boil it down to just like one soundbite because there's a lot going on there. But, you know, I give Emerson full credit for evolving into, you know, a very powerful abolitionist orator. And he said something, I think, towards the end of the Civil War that moves me enormously, where he said he was very inspired by the fact that black men were finally allowed to take up arms, because the federal government would not allow that to happen for quite a while in the early phase of the Civil War. Emerson loved the fact that that happened. And late in the Civil War, maybe right at the end, he said that he felt that the emblem of the United States should be not the bald eagle, but, as he put it, the Negro soldier lying in a trench near the Potomac with a spelling book in one hand and a musket in the other. Mm-hmm. And now I find that quite beautiful, mm-hmm, because he is essentially saying that this double emancipation, in other words, the literal and political breaking of the shackles, along with the fact that enslaved people are not allowed to learn to read. And so there was a breaking of that, of the forced limitations of consciousness that were part of that. That he was saying, like, that's the best America has to offer. That should be the emblem of this country. And I just find that enormously beautiful, you know. And to me, that's the beautiful, inspiring part of Emerson saying what I don't think a lot of white Americans would have said at that time. And so I just feel like, let's give credit where credit is due, and let's acknowledge that human beings are fallible. You know, we're compound creatures, and sometimes great, inspiring people say horrible things, and you look at the calculus and you figure it out.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, it was a complicated issue of the time. I mean, and I'm not crazy about presentism, and, you know, it's like, yeah, we can say it's wrong and it's awful, and it was, and you know, but it's one of those things where, What was it at the time that people, how were they thinking about this? How were they wrestling with it? There's things that we do now that people 50 years from now are going to say, how did you guys do that? Why were you guys doing
it? 10 years from now.
Right, 10 years from now. And I'm not comparing it to slavery necessarily, but it's just there are things that at every age that are immoral, and there are things that are wrong. And because people are complicated or issues are complicated, I would fully agree with you. I think that we have to say, yeah, okay, no, he didn't. Wasn't, you know, an abolitionist from the womb, but, you know, he got there and he still had, you know, complicated, you know, ideas. And I think on certain issues, people have that. And I think we give credit where it's due and criticize where we should. So I think that's totally fair. The, yeah. the, the last question here is about legacy. So more specifically, you know, how do we think about Emerson and his ideas and his thoughts and the kind of idea of being a, you know, sort of kind of, you know, human secular thinker? How do we understand that now in the 21st century and our current day, not just as a historian or someone that had some good essays in the 19th century, but how do we see him as relevant still, if we do, in current day?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, first of all, I think, you know, his mandate to figure things out for yourself is still really great advice.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, one of the things that's funny to think about this particular issue in the age of the internet is that, you know, in the earlier, more utopian phase of internet culture, everybody thought that the internet would be a fantastic and democratizing phenomenon because it would eliminate the top-down dissemination of wisdom or what passed for wisdom, and everybody would have the same megaphone and we would all be equal. And in a way, it seemed very Emersonian. It's almost an Emersonian thing. And in fact, Emerson believed in something called the oversoul, which we haven't discussed, which is very much like the cloud without the technology. You know, it was the idea that there was a communal consciousness and everyone was connected to it and could sometimes be very directly connected to it. But the thing is that the internet, not surprisingly, has turned out, of course, in some ways to be a great democratizing thing, but it has also simply reproduced some of the ugly traits that we were supposed to get away from, so that the internet is also just like a whirlpool of herd behavior and piling on and viral ugliness where a single voice is drowned out quite easily. So to have someone say to you what you think and perceive really matters, matters as much as everything you're told, I think is just still immensely important. I also think that it seeped into American religious culture as well. I mean, in a kind of weird sideways manner, because Emerson was never an evangelical. I mean, evangelicals with the sort of performative aspects of evangelical practice, he was in his own way a very buttoned up person. He was a Boston Unitarian. They couldn't take what they called enthusiasm. That was their keyword for the whole revivalism that swept the entire country, you know, starting like in 1803. But there is an important part of evangelicalism that has to do with having a direct relationship to God, that you see him directly, that you don't really need the mediation of a minister. And in fact, there's an evangelical tradition that the more highly trained, the more knowing the minister is, the more that person will get in the way of direct experience of the divine. And so I think that's very Emersonian, and it's still a very big part of American culture. So I think those aspects of him are very, very, very much alive. Another thing is that he's a great writer.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We can put aside for a moment the importance of his thought and the abstract, sometimes concepts that he promulgated. But he's just absolutely one of the greatest American writers. I mean, I say in my book, oh, he was the first great American writer. I don't really believe in those rankings. We could argue who's number one. It doesn't really matter. But I think because he was thinking so early specifically about American identity and articulating it, he seems like a good nominee. But also, he had a transcendent relationship to language, you know, which you and I haven't been talking about much here. But he is the writer of like thousands of the greatest American sentences, some of which just have turned into cliches or sound almost like proverbs because they're so in the culture, like the whole, you know, build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door, hitch your wagon to a star. I mean, we just think these things are always there, but, you know, he wrote them. But putting aside the ones that turned into cliches, like I make this argument in my book that he's essentially a great aphoristic writer. He really works by the sentence and sometimes by the paragraph. But he's really he's a sprinter. You know, he's not a marathon writer, as we kind of mentioned earlier. And, you know, someone who wants some of the most electrifying language really has to just open up one of his essays and don't actually look for the unfolding linear logic and coherence of a regular essay, because these essays were not written that way. They are essentially anthologies of his greatest sentences. But if you want to just read around, you'll something, some lightning will come off the page into your brain. I mean, they're just amazing, amazing sentences that are, I mean, they're capturing something important about human life or about culture, the way we get through our days, but they're just awesome as language. Mm-hmm. And his force field affected everybody in the 19th century. The 19th century was like a great, that was a good time for American writing once it got rolling. But everybody from Walt Whitman and Henry David Thoreau, who were disciples, importantly, to the great feminist Margaret Fuller, to people a little further out who, you know, William James, key philosopher of the 19th century, his brother Henry James, who in some ways was put off by Emerson, but drawn to him at the same time. Melville, Hawthorne, everybody had to reckon with him, even if they didn't write like him. He is just the gigantic, you know, forefather influence of the 19th century. And his, you know, his style and way of thinking are still important parts of just how Americans think and just process the world. So, I mean, in a way, that was the main goal of my book, to sort of dig Emerson out from under the Victorian rubble and just show him as a person who could talk very directly to someone in 2023 or 2024. Because I thought if he could speak that directly to me, it was worth me trying to communicate that in turn to a reader. You know? And if I've done that, even with a small number of readers, like, okay, then I succeeded, because that was the goal. And again, once you... I really feel that once you get a sense of how his brain works and how his language comes out, he doesn't seem antique and opaque in the way that he has come to be for many people. Because I plainly acknowledge that, like, a regular, intelligent, curious reader who dives straight into Emerson, parachutes, like, right into Self-Reliance, he can be really tough to read. So, you know, you have to get used to the rewards he has for you.
Yeah.
Because there's no use denying it. You know, it's like he's not an easy read for a lot of 21st century people. But my argument is that he's worth attuning yourself to. Because once you do, he speaks to you just plain as day. And it's beautiful and transformative.
I fully agree. I mean, he is someone that reminds me a lot of Nietzsche in the sense of, you know, the aphoristic style. And obviously, he's a much better writer. But It's once you get the kind of rhythm of it, it can be very digestible. You don't need to read, you know, 70 pages to get what the main idea is. Like it's able to be distilled a lot. You can really think about a lot of things. And I read some of him when I was preparing and reading the book, and I went back and pulled some stuff off my shelf and was like, yeah, I forgot how good this was, you know, so I hadn't read him in a while. So
no, it's easy to forget. And I mean, you know, no, Nietzsche loved Emerson. Mm-hmm. You know, his copy of Emerson's book in his library was the most heavily annotated, his German translation of the essays, I think, of all the books in his library. I mean, I think Nietzsche's a great writer also, but I mean, I would be lying if I said that I never have been bored by reading Emerson. You know, there are times of the day, there are moods of my own where it's like, I'm not prepared for it.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah.
But you know, when you're ready for it, when you can receive it, it is just so beautiful. I mean, I'll just read one last little thing. You know, try to put some flesh on what I'm just saying. I was just thinking about this beautiful quote before. It's from one of his most famous essay, Circles. And he says, "The one thing which we seek with insatiable desire is to forget ourselves, to be surprised out of our propriety, to lose our sempiternal memory, and to do something without knowing how or why. In short, to draw a new circle. Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. The way of life is wonderful. It is by abandonment." Now, I just think that's absolutely beautiful. There are two or three words in there that, like, a modern reader might say, okay, I'm going to look those up. But, you know, that passage is so key to everything that is so beautiful about him. The idea that what you really want sometimes is to surprise yourself, to not do what you do automatically every day, to just break out of the rut and suddenly find yourself in a new moment and a new sensation. And even when he says, the way of life is wonderful, it is by abandonment, even that last phrase, to me, points truthfully and in a way painfully in two directions at once. Because I think he means there are parts of your life that must be abandoned, that you'll have to let go of, including the loss of people you love. But also by abandonment, meaning a kind of abandonment in yourself, a kind of untrammeled, uncontrolled joy and openness. So I feel a passage like that could have been written, you know, 5 days ago. Mm-hmm. And I think I would love for my book to be like a conduit for people to get to Emerson, mm. you know, to be drawn into his life and his mind and then realize like, oh yes, this person is speaking right at me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think he's very, very accessible in that way. And people need to hopefully your book, which is very good, will be a nice renaissance of Emerson.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
James, this was so much fun. I really, really enjoyed the conversation, talking about Emerson. I really enjoyed talking about all the really big themes. It really was just such a delight, and a big, big, big thanks for doing this.
Thank you. It was a thrill to talk to you. And again, I really appreciate you inviting me onto the show. So thanks a lot.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you.